All right, welcome back to yet another beautiful week of, well, I guess it's not a whole week, maybe just a couple hours of Truth Jihad Radio. But it'll keep you going through the rest of the week until it happens again next week. I'm Kevin Barrett. I do this show every Saturday night right here on RepublicBroadcasting.org, where you can trade in your worthless green paper for real precious metals, at least while supply lasts. Okay, well, tonight I've got a great show coming at you. My guest tonight is in very illustrious company. You know, there are, as far as I know, I may be wrong, and I may be very quickly corrected on this, but as far as I know, there are three people who have lost tenure track or tenured jobs at our institutions of higher learning, such as they are, because those three people were pursuing the truth about 9/11 and speaking publicly about it. Now, I happen to be one of those people. The other two, however, are far more illustrious and qualified than I am. And it's interesting, those two people happen to be very well known in the 9/11 truth movement, among our best known scientific voices, and they are Judy Wood and Stephen Jones. Now, most folks in the 9/11 truth movement know that there have been some differences in approaches to the science of 9/11 between these two people, but you know something, I am proud to be in such company. I don't know why the powers that be decided to pick on me alongside people who are this eminently qualified. And I haven't had Judy on the show until tonight, so I am really happy to bring her on, because Judy's website, you know, whether you agree with all of her interpretations or not, her website is absolutely indispensable. Just like Eric Hufschmidt's book is indispensable for the photographs that you can find in that book, even if you might not agree with Eric Hufschmidt on all other issues, Judy Wood's website is a absolutely astounding and utterly crucial source and resource for anybody interested in trying to figure out what happened to the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Dr. Wood has endured a fair amount of vilification from people both inside and outside the 9/11 truth movement. I don't think that's justified, and I hope people will listen to what she has to say, take a look at her website, look at the photos, keep an open mind, and think about them, because you're going to be challenged when you look at those pictures and when you hear what Judy has to say about them. So, hey, without further ado, welcome Dr. Judy Wood. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. Is Jerry online?
And we got Jerry. Okay, and we also have Jerry Liepart, an attorney who has filed a request for corrections with NIST. And perhaps before I start talking with you guys, let me just say I apologize. I made a mistake, in a sense, a couple of weeks ago when I wrote up a blistering op-ed about NIST admitting that it has absolutely no explanation for the collapse, the total collapse of the Twin Towers. And in fact, they had admitted pretty much the same thing to you guys a couple of months earlier. In fact, way back in March, wasn't it? Wait, when did they answer you filed your
in July.
In March.
Yeah, it was in July, and what they had said is that they didn't analyze what happened after the point that the building started to come apart. They didn't analyze it.
Didn't even look at it.
Right, and that's one of the issues that I brought to them.
And that is an astounding admission. And of course, I wrote this up after I had encountered a piece on the other request for correction from NIST coming from the other people affiliated with the other scholars group. And you wrote me and pointed out quite correctly that, in fact, NIST had already admitted the same thing to you 2 months ago. Okay, it looks like we're coming into a break. So we'll be right back. This is Kevin Barrett with Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. Stick around. This is Kevin Barrett here at RepublicBroadcasting.org doing this Truth Jihad Radio show every Saturday night. And my guests tonight are Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. They filed a request for correction with NIST, which had given us a 10,000-page pseudo-explanation of how a collapse of the World Trade Center towers might have initiated. That is, if you accept their extreme tweaking of every bit of data that they got their hands on. But they didn't even bother to try to explain how this total collapse itself actually happened. All they did was explain how a couple of floors could have lost their vertical supports. So this is really a preposterous fraud. And Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart, you filed a request for correction back in March, and got an answer admitting that they hadn't even tried to explain the actual collapse. Why do you think that they gave
us... That's correct, Kevin. Yeah. And first of all, I'd just like to say that it's a pleasure to be on the show with you. And, of course, you know, Dr. Wood, I do have the privilege of representing Dr. Wood as legal counsel. In connection with the legal action that she has taken. And I'll get into that from a legal point of view in just a second. But, you know, what I want to say first is that neither Judy nor I, you know, think any sort of apology is, you know, is necessary from you concerning the calling attention to the way that NIST responded to the other RFC request for correction that had been filed by other members, other active members of the 9/11 Truth community, and including some who were representative of the victims' families. We think it's good that their RFC was mentioned and was mentioned in the light that had to do with calling attention to the fact that the NIST report was such a you know, such a misrepresentation of the actual event for not explaining what happened in the actual destructive phase. Now it is true that Judy's RFC was filed earlier and did receive an earlier reply that that said much the same thing, but you know there's no conflict in that respect.
Well, and, I agree completely, but I know that Judy, you were a little annoyed with me when I published that and didn't even, you know, and I neglected to mention yours.
It did not even analyze the collapse, so they could not even imply the cause of collapse.
Right. Like
you had implied a cause, but My big issue with them is they didn't even analyze beyond, what was it, I forgot the exact time.
The initiation
1030,
of, quote, collapse, unquote, is the way they phrased it. Now, Kevin, you also mentioned another key word, that word being fraud, and it is also now become a matter of public record, and so therefore something that Judy and I can mention. And that is, in addition to the request for correction or RFC process, Judy actually has what is called a QI-TAM lawsuit pending that names the principal contractors that NIST used as defendants, where the claim is that those contracting companies, and if you read through the list of them, you will see that it includes many members who are what you would call the cream of the military-industrial complex crop as defendants. And among the, to me anyway, absolutely astonishing developments is that NIST relied on, for purposes of technical and administrative support, two companies that are really among the major developers and manufacturers of directed energy weapons. And we refer here to Applied Research Associates, Incorporated, or ARA, and also to Science Applications International Corp, or SAIC. Your listeners might be well advised to find out more about those two companies, ARA and SAIC, and I think if they do so, they will undergo what I would call jaw-dropping experiences when they find out the extent to which those two companies stand at the epicenter of two principal aspects of warfare. One is directed energy. energy weaponry, and the other is psychological operations.
Well, that is a pretty interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? With the directed energy warfare, of course, a lot of people in the 9/11 truth movement are really not aware of what's going on in this field. And so when they hear people speculating about that having something to do or possibly having something to do with the way the towers were demolished, they find this exotic. And as Ken Jenkins told me the other day, there are some people who just don't want to go there into any kind of speculation that sounds exotic. But actually, directed energy weapons apparently are not all that unusual or out there. You know, I talked to Doug Rocky, who was a former Army guy. He described them running around playing with like microwave-type weapons and testing them on people and on each other. He talked about the truck-mounted ones, the plane-mounted ones, van-mounted ones. And this is something that was very, you know, very common among some people he was actually working with in the U.S. Army. They were zapping people. This was many years ago. So maybe people should take a look at this and see how exotic this really is.
Well, you know, you started your show by, of course, requesting that people take a look at, Judy's website. As people do so, you know, they will find that quite a lot of information about the status of development of development and deployment of directed energy weaponry can be found both on her website and then, of course, through independent and online research. Obviously, there's a lot that is, you know, not within the public domain, and a lot that is covered by one form of security classification or another. But there is, quite a bit in the public domain.
Yes, right. Bob Petrakis, who's a well-known an election analyst. He was in Ohio when the elections were stolen in 2004. Leading academic researchers came to our conference in Madison in August and discussed some research he's done on these kinds of weapons. And it's clear that they exist. What's not clear, of course, is to what extent they exist and how powerful they are and exactly what they can do.
That's correct. And it's also, I think, not that well known that. You know, part of the research approach that Dr. Wood has taken is to seek to engage with the directed energy professional community. There is such a community. There is, for example, what is called the Directed Energy Directorate, and that is a joint military operation or a joint task force, meaning that it is an inter-service branch of the military, and its basic function is to manage and oversee the nation's stockpile of such weapons. They are located at Kirtland Air Force Base, just outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico. They have a website. They have military and civilian employees. Most of those employees have names and telephone numbers and email addresses. So Dr. Wood, for her part, decided that it might be a good idea to call up a few of them, send correspondence to others of them, and ask them the point-blank question by presenting them with some of her uniquely presented visual and photographic information, and asked them if the effects seen in the photographs were consistent with the lethal effects that would be expected from the use of such weapons.
And what sort of answers did she get?
Equivocal ones.
Such as?
Oh, gee, well, we don't have enough money to do that kind of research.
Well, somebody did make a fair bit of money on 9/11 between all the put options, the $2.3 trillion that apparently disappeared from the Pentagon on the watch of Dove Zakheim. Now,
I guess we can continue this on the other side of the break.
I guess we'll have to.
From a legal point of view, if someone asked you a question like that, you would expect the answer to be flat no, if that were the answer.
Okay, we are back playing those mind games here at True Jihad Radio, RBNLive.com. And today, for the first time, I'm having one of our leading 9/11 researchers, Judy Wood, and a very brave lawyer who's requesting correction from NIST and not getting much of an answer, Jerry Liebhardt. And Jerry, this is pretty interesting stuff that you're finding out about Applied Research Internet or Associates, is it ARA and SAIC, Scientific Application International Corps? I get that right. These companies specialize in both psychological operations and directed energy. That sounds like an interesting combination, given the kind of hypotheses that Dr. Wood has come up with concerning the destruction of the World Trade Center towers.
Well, I'll let Judy speak to that, of course, but I can tell you that in researching what NIST did, going into it, I would not have expected and did not expect to find that their principal contractors, for purposes of writing the report on what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center, would be companies whose expertise were in the two areas mentioned, namely directed energy weaponry and psychological warfare. But that is, in fact, the case.
And that certainly it does bear investigating. And, I think that a lot of people in the 9/11 Truth Movement, even probably the majority of those who are on sort of the more conservative side of the way they try to deal with evidence, would admit that the material on your website, Judy, needs to be investigated and is very interesting. Many of those people, though, feel that they're really afraid to speak publicly about a directed energy hypothesis for the demolition of the towers because they're afraid that the so-called debunkers, who I call the bunkers because they're peddling bunk, will be able to try to smear us as sort of science fiction people.
I'm looking for what happened on 9/11 for the truth. And I try not to be swayed by outside pressures to come up with a different answer other than the truth. And in doing so, basically on my website is data, is evidence. And you can call it hard evidence. Pages upon pages of look at what happened. And through looking at what happened, you can eliminate what didn't happen.
And one of the interesting things on your website, of course, is the many photos showing that the pile at the World Trade Center towers was not even remotely what one would expect from a conventional controlled demolition. And this is a subject that I think still is eliciting confusion. There are people who are arguing that there was a pile 6 or 7 stories high at the World Trade Center. But if you look at the tower, what used to be the towers, World Trade Center 1 and 2, and you look at that pile, there are some photographs that suggest that there's almost no pile there at all. How would you describe just how much of a pile there was where the towers used to be?
Well, this particular picture that really captures it was in, I think, Time magazine, where you're looking north, northeast on West Street, towards Building 7, and you still see Building 7 standing, so you know what day this was. And from the shadows on the ground, you can see that it's before noon on 9/11. And you see Building 7. You see Building 6, which is an 8-story building, and you see nothing in front of it. There should be a 110-story building between you and Building 6. But you see stuff down to ground level. There's a little bit of the north wall, just the outer columns, and I call them wheat checks. They look like wheat checks. There's sets of 3 columns, 3 floors tall. There's a bunch of these. They're just about the height of Building 6, which is 8 stories tall, but there's nothing much else left of Tower 1.
At some point, Kevin, it almost becomes counterproductive to, you know, to indicate to people what the data actually show, what the information reveals, and to recognize that to a certain extent perception is reality, and the perception that was projected at us through media did include building the illusion that there was a huge rubble pile at Ground Zero. Now, you know, never mind that the site was immediately blocked off, never mind that the public was kept several blocks away, and that fences to obscure the public being able to visualize the site were erected. Never mind all of that. There does appear to have been a concerted effort to create the impression that there was a pile there. Now, you know, for
why
those of you
pile?
Who saw the mainstream movie about that Oliver Stone did, recall those who were trapped said as soon as they got out.
Now we're going to take a break. We'll have to pick this up after the break. We'll be right back. Just stick around. Truth Jihad Radio on republicbroadcasting.org. And in fact, they have a new source for their precious metals. It's now republictradinggroup.net. So if you want to trade in that worthless green paper before it becomes so cheap you can line your birdcage with it, just go to republictradinggroup.net and trade it in for gold, silver, or something else that may maintain its value through the coming collapse of the U.S. dollar. All right, well, today I'm talking with Judy Wood and Jerry Liebhardt, and we're just discussing the remarkable lack of a pile at the base of what used to be the Twin Towers. Normally, after controlled demolitions, you would get a pile, I believe, something like 12 to a little over 12% of the height of the building, which would be maybe 12 to 15 stories. And I've heard various estimates of how big this pile was, ranging up to maybe 6 or 7 stories, still not remotely what you would expect if there was a natural collapse. But in fact, there are several photos, and you can see some of them at Dr. Wood's website, where it certainly looks like there was a lot less than 6 or 7 stories. There was hardly any pile at all. And the question then becomes, well, what happened to these towers? And that's, I guess, the million-dollar question. What was it that turned these buildings to dust and shrapnel? And
Kevin, it's data can be very misleading, and of course we know that first of all there is a concerted effort to establish the assumption that the rubble pile was 6 or 7 stories tall or high, which is false. But nonetheless, the conventional wisdom does seek to implant that idea. And then the conventional wisdom also seeks to implant the idea that the sub-basement was so damaged and was so filled with debris, and since the sub-basement was 6 levels, that lo and behold, le voila, you have your 12-story rubble pile. But, you know, even in making the assumptions in the light that is most favorable to the conventional wisdom, in my view, it still fails because the underlying assumption that the pile should be 12 stories tall only applies in the instance where you assume there was one tower. Hello, there were 2 110-story towers there. Therefore, you should have at least 2 separate 12-story or 6-story piles, but more likely, since the buildings were so close one to the other, you should really have a 20-story high rubble pile. Those two buildings were enormous, each in their own right. And what we need to remember is that there were 2 of them. The conventional wisdom ducks that issue altogether.
Yeah, one of the photos I was referring to is at the website. It's drjudywood.com. That's D R JUDYWOOD.com, and it's figure 87D, where you can see the rubble pile with people walking around on it. There's a pedestrian bridge in the background. And there are some other photos that also show this bridge. Now, that bridge was, what was that, just, I think, a floor above street level, one story above street level. So that actually suggests that there's really no rubble pile at all there, that it was very close to ground level.
If folks go to my webpage, drjudywood.com, they'll see a row of pictures right below my picture. You'll see one that says lack of sufficient debris, page 6.
Right.
And that's the picture that we're talking about, I believe.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that they kept referring to this as the pile, as though it's...
As though there were a pile.
as though it's supposed to project, the idea of there's this huge pile. People kept calling it the pile, as though there was a pile.
Yes, it's quite astonishing. I spoke to a couple of New Yorkers who'd been there when I was in New York for the 6th anniversary event, and they confirmed that there was nothing there. They said there was essentially no pile, that was really the first I'd heard that, other than, hearing, I guess I had heard it briefly from you before, but it takes a while for these things to sink in.
Ever hear of a psychological operation?
Right. But that, this is just one of the many indications that what we're dealing with the Twin Towers is something very, very different from a conventional controlled demolition. And even those who have subscribed to something along the lines of a more conventional theory, such as explosives and perhaps thermite to cut the columns, will have to admit that it would be an amazing controlled demolition, because the tallest building that had ever been taken down in history was somewhere in the order of 40-some stories. It was, I think, shorter than even Building 7. So these towers were almost three times as tall as the tallest building that had ever been taken down in a conventional controlled demolition. It was a rather astounding feat any way you look at it. It wasn't just your garden variety controlled demolition, no matter what did it.
Right.
The buildings dissolved in midair. That's another issue that lends itself to perception management. One, in looking at the photos and at the available video, you see the buildings dissolving in midair. There's no information consistent with steel and building and office materials actually hitting the ground. There's no seismic data consistent with any such event. But yet the standard explanation succeeds in implanting the words collapse and other similar words that direct attention away from what the actual event entailed, namely the dissolution of steel and concrete on an almost instantaneous basis.
And I agree with you when you you've corrected people. Judy, you've corrected folks who talk about collapses and say that the word collapse is not the right word for what happened to the Twin Towers. These buildings exploded, were pulverized, and so on. We have a caller. It's Solomon from Canada. How are you doing, Solomon?
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
I've been very familiar with Judy Wood's work. I actually heard the first interview she did there with Mr. Fetzer. I guess probably over a year ago now, and it's actually the reason why I stopped listening to Mr. Fetzer's and your show in the first place. The reason why is because all the direct evidence points to demolition. I mean, we have the thermite residue, we have the very clear testimony of the firefighters that were there in the scene. So then to bring in talk about a space beam weapon from outer space. Now, we all know that there are directed energy weapons. But the idea of a directed energy weapon that's so huge that from outer space it can melt these gigantic structures is just very implausible, and it flies in the face of a lot of direct evidence that we have. Now, anyone that doubts
all his viewpoint.
Yeah, let's Solomon finish.
So anyone that doubts this should just go to journalof911studies.com and read Dr. Gregory S. Jenkins' article the overwhelming implausibility of using directed energy beams to demolish the World Trade Center on journalof911studies.com. Now, Kevin, have you read that article of Dr. Gregory S. Jenkins?
Yes, I have.
And what is your opinion of it?
Well, you know, I think that he has a point that as far as the known energy mechanisms, there's, you know, there's no plausible one that we can point to that could possibly project the kind of, the amount of energy that he's saying would be necessary to do this from a space platform. And that sounds like a good argument to me. At the same time, Solomon, if you look at the information on Dr. Wood's website, regardless of what kind of hypotheses you bring to bear on it, you do have to admit that there are some issues here that are quite difficult to explain, such as the complete lack of a rubble pile, such as the pulverization, and some of the other stuff. I'm not convinced by all of it. For instance, I'm not convinced that the issue of the molten metal is a red herring, as Dr. Wood suggests. I've seen so much evidence for that I find it implausible that that's all planted. So actually, when I try to put all this together, I don't see that much of a contradiction between what Dr. Wood is doing, at least in most of her work, and what Stephen Jones is doing in arguing for the presence of thermite. In that, this destruction of these buildings would have been planned with overkill. That is, they would make sure that there'd be nothing left. And it might very well, if they're trying out something brand new, which is what Dr. Wood's work would suggest, and I'm not saying I have any idea what this was, but obviously it was something brand new because nothing that big had ever been demolished before, and clearly it was pulverized in a way that most controlled demolitions are not. So given that they were doing something new, you would expect them to use massive overkill and, for instance, take out the columns with something like thermite, even as they were maybe either blowing it up with explosives or using some other energy source to explode these towers into dust and debris. But in either case, I don't see why you have to come up with an either-or hypothesis, and I certainly don't see why people on one side of this research path have to be constantly flinging ad hominem attacks and anger and so on at people on the other path.
Kevin, did you hear the interview that Mr. Fetzer did with Stephen Jones after this controversy began? Speaking of ad hominem attacks and flinging accusations.
Can we talk about the...
I did hear that interview, and I thought Jim did a kind of a ridiculous job of talking over Steve on that interview. However, that has nothing to do with the research question itself, and I am interested in
looking at the
research.
Well, with what you just said, the research.
I would like to talk about the evidence on my website.
Right. To the caller, greetings, and hope you're doing well in Canada. We here in the U.S. A lot to look up to Canada about. You're a functioning democracy where, we here in the U.S. are on the verge of becoming a police state.
Well, Canada's about to be annexed into the New World Order, though, so don't feel too safe up there, Solomon.
No, I certainly don't.
Speaking for both myself and Dr. Wood, we respect your viewpoint. We invite you to look at the evidence in the way that seems compelling and persuasive to you. I would invite you to consider, however, that some of the descriptions that you attribute to us did not originate with us. Judy does not refer to her work as, how did you describe it, space beams from outer space. Now, it is true and acknowledged that directed energy weaponry have been developed for possible placement on satellites for decades. And even though under the Outer Space Treaty that has been in effect for many decades, it is illegal to place weapons in space. It is almost certain that the United States, as well as perhaps Russia and China and one or two other countries, have found the temptation to put weapons in space to be overwhelming, and have in fact put them there. The fact that there may be weapons in space does not translate easily, in my view, into a criticism of Dr. Wood for her assertions that the destructive evidence and the lethal effects seen at Ground Zero are consistent with the use of directed energy weapons. Such weapons, in addition to being in space, are on platforms in low Earth orbit, at high altitude, at mid-range altitude, at low altitude, on land, and at sea. And you can find out a bit more about the placement of such weapons by taking a look at publications put out by the Directed Energy Professional Society. That is an organization established in 1999, and it was formed by companies that comprise the cream of the military-industrial complex. And, oh, by the way, ARA and SAIC are primary sponsors of the Directed Energy Professional Society. So please feel free to look at that data where you can ascertain the extent to which directed energy weapons have been deployed.
And well, I'm aware that clearly there is evidence for explosions, and from the initial explosions below the surface that William Rodriguez has described and the seismic evidence tells us about, to all sorts of other explosions that eyewitnesses reported. I don't think anybody argues that there weren't any explosions. But Dr. Wood, you're rather controversial in arguing that perhaps these could have been decoys. In other words, rather than seeing this, as I do, as a case in which there may have been a sort of overkill plan to eliminate these buildings, you've argued that. But now, why would they make obvious explosions, which would just hang them for normal controlled demolition? That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, there are many explanations for the sound of explosions. What you are reporting is the sound of explosions and things moving, perhaps, if you're talking about the seismograph. Now, there are a lot of explanations. There are explanations I have read about in some of the first responder transcripts in which, the air tanks that firemen use to go into a burning building, make sure they can breathe, they have oxygen tanks. There were some left in a fire truck that exploded. Now, why would they explode? Well, if you have something that turns steel to dust, and you have a steel air tank that is in the process of turning into dust, as soon as the wall becomes thin enough, that pressurized air is going to explode. And I'll bet that the building had a whole lot of pressurized tanks of various sorts in there. And you see those, what folks call squibs, squirting out. If you look at them carefully, they're not really explosions, but gusts of air or gas or dust or something. There's something being ejected out with like a air and pressure. And I'm wondering if there's some sort of tank that's in the building that just started dissolving and maybe popped the regulator off the end or something like that.
Well, maybe. I'm not convinced by this one, but we'll talk about it some more in a few moments. Be right back. Kevin Buren on Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio right here at republicbroadcasting.org. Tonight I'm talking with Jerry Liepart, an attorney who's filed a request for corrections from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which gave us a 10,000-page report on how collapse initiation happened at the World Trade Center towers, meaning that a couple of floors supposedly lost their vertical support. That was highly implausible already, but they didn't tell us how a couple of floors losing their vertical support would have led to the complete disappearance of these buildings at free fall speed. And indeed, they didn't even try to explain that, and they admitted to Dr. Wood and then to the other group that filed a similar request a month later that they had not even tried to explain that. So, Judy, when I look at the photos of these squibs, okay, and I hear you suggesting that there's some sort of natural explanation through tanks exploding. Well, somehow that doesn't convince me, and I'll tell you why. Well, first, if we look at all of the evidence for explosions
much of it is very, very persuasive, such as the testimony of William Rodriguez and more than a dozen other people, including several who were badly injured in those sub-basement explosions that happened before the first event, presumably the plane hitting up above. And then we also have eyewitness testimony describing a massive explosion in the lobby of Building 7 that happened sometime, you know, a little bit after 9 a.m., before the towers were destroyed. And that description is quite vivid. It looked like King Kong stepped on the lobby. It was just, you know, there were bodies everywhere in Building 7. So clearly there was a massive explosion in Building 7 that did a tremendous amount of damage and killed a number of people at 9-something in the morning. And clearly there was a massive explosion at the sub-basement level of the North Tower before the first event up where the plane hit. So, you know, this is just the beginning of a whole lot of reasons to believe that there were quite a number of explosions going off that day. And when I look at these squibs, they look like squibs from controlled demolitions. To me, that's the sort of Occam's razor explanation. And so I'm wondering what, you know, it seems like you're stretching things on a Procrustean bed a little bit to try to explain away these squibs and to explain away other evidence for explosions, for thermite, for molten metal, and so on. Am I wrong about this?
Let me, we've got to back up just a moment, Kevin, and that is that, you know, in addition to filing the RFC with NIST, you know, it should be made very clear to your listeners that, you know, Dr. Wood has started a lawsuit, not just an RFC at NIST, but an actual lawsuit naming as defendants ARA, SAIC, and the other NIST contractors who participated in the fraud that was the NIST report supposedly telling us what happened, but which they did not do so. So that is a QI-TAM lawsuit where Dr. Wood is the relator and is suing on behalf of the United States of America against the defendants who participated in that fraud. Now, that is the crucible or the place where the issue of the validity of the evidence that Dr. Wood has brought forward will be tested.
And I look forward to that lawsuit.
We gain nothing by seeking to argue, clarify, or go one up with other people in the truth community about the theories of destruction that they hold to be true.
And I agree, and we'll be picking up from there when we come back and in just a moment. So stick around, folks. Second hour of Truth Jihad Radio right here on republicbroadcasting.org, where we bring on all sorts of interesting and sometimes controversial people. And today we have couple of great guests, Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart, who are requesting correction from NIST, trying to find out exactly what's the story behind their ridiculous pseudo-explanation of what happened at the Twin Towers. And I highly recommend that people take a look at Dr. Judy Wood's website at drjudywood.com. There's all sorts of evidence there that serves our most important purpose, which is to disprove the official story of 9/11, and at that point, once we've done that, which isn't all that difficult, we're in a position to demand the information that would allow us to find out what did happen.
So let me say something here. I'm the one who filed the RFC, but what Jerry has helped me with is in filing the QI-TAM case, and that's what I think he was talking about.
Okay.
So not to confuse the two.
Right, two separate issues. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And I filed an appeal to the NIST request for correction in August. And there was a lot of very good information in that about what I found about ARA and the conflict of interest that of which is brought to light in the fact that NIST has a contract with ARA on the NIST report.
And how much money did they spend, or did they give to ARA?
See, we don't know the exact amount that that ARA received. We know that the NIST overall NIST budget. had one of the more significant contracts among a group of contractors. But as the lawsuit proceeds, we would expect to be in a position to either, you know, mention what the public records disclose or what developments occur in the QTAM lawsuit.
And I hope we get to that stage where we'll find this out, because in the past, most lawsuits associated with 9/11 have sort of run up against a kind of a glass ceiling at the point where discovery comes in and the government says they can't have to submit to discovery because national security is involved. And as I don't believe any 9/11 lawsuit has ever reached discovery. Is this something that we're going to reach with this suit?
Well, that is a well formulated question. You know, we can't be certain of that. Certainly, we will expect that the defendants will seek you know, vigorously to avoid having to encounter that stage. But right now, it's very much an open question, and all Judy and I think, can say is to stand by for further developments.
Okay, and I'll be looking forward to those further developments and to our further conversation when we come back from this this quick break. We had a very short segment here, but we'll be back with a longer segment in just a moment. This is Kevin Barrett here on Truth Jihad Radio. I'm talking with Jerry Liebhardt and Dr. Judy Wood. So, stick around. Call in if you want to. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio right here on RepublicBroadcasting.org, where you can get America, Freedom to Fascism, a wonderful DVD from the late lamented Aaron Rousseau. You can also go to RepublicTradingGroup.net and cash in that green stuff for real precious metals. We do have another caller. Before I bring him on, though, let me just say that I'm impressed when people are doing something productive for 9/11 truth, such as these lawsuits and requests for correction. I deplore it when people call each other names and insinuate that folks who have a different opinion about certain aspects of the evidence around 9/11 are bad people or spies or disinformation agents and this sort of thing. I must say that I am a friend of Stephen Jones, and I also respect the work of Dr. Judy Wood. They are the only two people besides myself who've been forced out of tenured or tenure track professor jobs due to speaking out on 9/11. And I'm proud to be in their company and proud to have Judy on the show tonight. And the next caller is Jake from Louisiana. Come in, Jake.
Good evening.
Hey, good evening to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Another great show, Dr. Barrett.
Well, thanks.
Dr. Woods, it's an honor and a privilege to be on the same show with you.
Thank you.
I'm an old engineer down in South Louisiana, and I'm an associate member of Jim Petras Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And I've discussed with him a bit on via email the question of the amount of energy required to accomplish the demolition of the two towers. Am I correct in saying that about 250,000 tons of mass is missing from each of these buildings?
500,000 tons each for each building.
500,000. So that's a million tons of matter was essentially pulverized or vaporized, right?
Was turned to dust. Is missing. Let's say it's missing.
It seems to me it would take an enormous amount of energy to do that. And the question you are trying to answer, and a lot of us are trying to answer, is where did the energy come from to do this much damage in that short a period of time? Is that the gist of it?
That's not really where my position is, but I would like to answer that issue. And what I was wanting to answer earlier, that it's not necessarily what people think. If you say, well, how many matchsticks would it take to destroy the tower? You know, because the only way I know how to destroy things is through matchsticks. So it would take too many matchsticks, so therefore the tower couldn't have been destroyed. But if you notice, first of all, the buildings aren't there anymore. I think we can all agree on that. Something destroyed them, and from all of the visual evidence, we see the building essentially was turned to dust, or is gone. It's turned to powder, gone away. And so we have to look at what happened. That's first and foremost, is this motto that I really like, is experimental evidence is the truth that theory must mimic. You don't start with a theory and then try to fit the data to the theory. You start with the data, the evidence, the true evidence. And so we see the buildings are gone. Whatever happened to them, it was possible because they're gone. And then the other question is, have we seen this before? No. There are a lot of top secret things out there. We don't know what all is in the arsenal. We don't know the serial numbers, but we do know whatever it was effective.
Well, now, the problem that I'm running into is trying to determine, or not determine necessarily, but figure out what type of device would be required to provide the energy to vaporize a million tons of concrete and steel in a matter of seconds.
Well, let me ask you this question. I mean, the current explanation would hold that the principal energy source was two things, one being gravity and the other being kerosene. I would think that in addition to asking the question that you're asking about the energy source would be a second observation, that observation being that whatever else you can say about gravity and about kerosene, those two energy sources taken separately together or in any combination are grossly insufficient to have caused the results seen.
Exactly. They would be a drop in a bathtub as compared to the amount of energy required to do the damage that actually took place.
Right. Paul Craig Roberts has talked about the massive energy deficit
exactly.
The government's explanation.
That's
that actually pertains to all attempts at explanation. As you've said, I think this is a very apropos comment, Jake, that currently we don't have an easy way of understanding just how these buildings could be pulverized in 10 seconds.
That's why I respect all of Dr. Wood's work so much. She is trying to answer that question.
Or at least to explore all avenues for understanding what happened.
There's an explanation that I gave in Madison during my talk. It's sort of as an analogy that if you were going to, 200 years ago, tell someone that you could put an image of them on a piece of paper with light, they would say that would take an unbelievable amount of light to burn an image into a piece of paper. How would you control it? But then once you learn about photographic emulsion, it just takes a tiny bit of light to trigger the chemical reaction in photographic emulsion. So it isn't necessarily just the light that does it. It's the light is the switch that triggers the chemical reaction and controls the chemical reaction on the photographic emulsion. So let's say we have some kind of beam that is a trigger that can control some other reaction. It doesn't necessarily need to be the beam 100%. It isn't that we're cooking the building. The building didn't get cooked. You see people running down the street with the cloud chasing them. The cloud passes them, and you don't have cooked bodies. It wasn't hot. So there was something else going on, but what we do know from the evidence is that certain materials break down and others do not. And if you had a kinetic energy device where you had an explosive, dynamite or whatnot, it doesn't choose between materials. Everything gets blown up in all directions. But what we see is something that's very directed and it's assigned to specific materials. Like steel would turn to dust as it fell to the air, but aluminum would not. And after all, we know all of the paper that was around all over Manhattan that didn't get burned up.
And that's all such interesting and anomalous evidence
And when, you know, people tell me that, oh, we shouldn't talk about this, you know, you shouldn't have Judy on the show because this speculating about these exotic weapons just makes us look kooky. Now, my response to that is, well, let's live in the real world, folks. You know, we had the Manhattan Project more than 50 years ago, which, you know, before the Manhattan Project, if people had said that you could produce this much energy from a handful of matter, they would have said that's impossible. It violates the laws of physics, or some would at least. And we've had the equivalent of many, many Manhattan projects in the military-industrial complex since World War II, and those projects have been kept secret, and they are aimed at developing new technologies of destruction. So I don't think it's particularly science fiction-ish to speculate on, or to even, you know, say flat out that there must be some all sorts of weapons, the equivalent of breakthroughs that were, you know, very much the equivalent of the breakthrough that gave us atomic weapons, nuclear weapons. There have undoubtedly been a number of such breakthroughs, and it's undoubtedly most or all of those are top secret.
And let us also recall that the way weapon procurement occurs is that it gets subcontracted to what we call the military-industrial complex. And, you know, at some level, it operates where the military-industrial complex turns over to the military chain of command or to the Department of Defense the weapons thus developed. In connection with 9/11, one must seriously consider the possibility that secret weapons may exist that may or may not be firmly within the control of the military chain of command of the U.S.
And that point, of course, is more apropos than ever, just a month or so after a couple of months after the loose nukes were put on B-52s in a complete violation of protocol and flown across the U.S. on B-52 bombers.
Excellent analogy.
Right, and that may not be the only time that a secret or destructive weapon has slipped out of the normal command and control pattern.
Kevin, it couldn't have happened because we know that everything is always within the control of the military. I'm teasing.
I'm sure that we're very ignorant of the weaponry that the black ops have created since 1950s, especially when they tell us a plan like the SR-71, which was designed in 1955, is still the fastest aircraft that was ever built. You kind of have to laugh at it.
Yeah, there must be something over at the Skunk Works that can beat that. All right, we'll be back in a few minutes here. This is Kevin Barrett on Troop Jihad Radio, having a wonderful conversation with Jerry Leapart and Dr. Judy Wood, and Jake from Louisiana. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back here at Troop Jihad Radio, jumping right back into it with Jake from Louisiana and Jerry Leapart and Dr. Judy Wood. When people try to tell me that, we shouldn't talk about these exotic hypotheses in public, just we should talk about them in private. And that's the way it was described to me by Ken Jenkins yesterday. He's one of the sensitive people and the more reticent people who are not, you know, not advocating that we go all out on the directed energy weapon stuff in public. I'm not sure, that there may be something to that politically, but in terms of trying to figure out what the truth is, the argument that secrets cannot be kept, right? This is an argument that the debunkers supposedly use against 9/11 truth, that, well, yeah, they couldn't keep that kind of a secret. And likewise, is there some kind of exotic weaponry that could pulverize the towers? Well, no, of course there couldn't be, because there can't be any secrets. Well, you point out counterexamples. You say, look, they kept the Manhattan Project secret for years with hundreds of thousands of people working on it. They kept Northwood secret, a plan to murder large numbers of American civilians in terrorist bombings, have a fake shootdown of an airliner full of non-existent passengers, blow up a ship on the high seas, all these, murder lots of Americans to start a war. Every member of the Joint Chiefs signed off on it. Hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands knew about it, and yet it was kept completely secret for 40 years. So you point that out, and then they say, this just proves it because we found out about that. It's not a secret anymore. Well, this is a logical fallacy. There's no such thing as a secret because you don't know about the secret until it's no longer a secret, right? Wrong. It doesn't work that way. Just as people were still unaware of Operation Northwoods in 1965, 1975, 1985, and 1995, we may still be unaware of a whole lot of things right now. And if academicians would get off their arrogant butts and wake up and smell the coffee, they would realize this and realize that they don't know everything that there is to know. At least that's my opinion. But what's yours, guest?
I think it's important that we look at the evidence, look at the data. We had two 110-story buildings, each 500,000 tons each, go away. They're not there anymore. There's just dust left. Could this happen anywhere else?
And it,
do we care?
And it's so clear that the official story that this was caused by kerosene and supposedly a couple of columns bent out of shape by airliner impacts, it's so ludicrous. And I really think we should focus hard on that and really pummel and pulverize and demolish the official story. And that should be the focus of our efforts. And I think it would be a good idea to sort of lay off of going after people within the 9/11 truth movement who have different emphases on the evidence they look at, and instead save our vitriol for these lunatics and morons and cover-up artists and you know, people who are complicit in high treason and mass murder and war crimes and crimes against humanity. Those are the people that we should be going after, not other people in the movement who have a different way of doing things than we do.
Yeah, I fully agree with that there's nothing to be gained by challenging or castigating one another. You know, for my part, I really do try, you know, very hard to not do that myself and to counsel, you know, those people that I have, you know, a relationship with as their legal counsel to, you know, counsel them, you know, not to do that either. Tempting though the opportunity to engage in that kind of argument may be. I mean, you know, people, it's a natural human reaction, I think, to respond, and particularly to respond if one, is being criticized, you know, much less, you know, called all sorts of names. But the, discretion is the better part of valor, and, I know for those who may not like the directed energy weapons, you know, causal theory, that, you know, all I can say is that the issue, you know, has been put squarely and firmly into court. It is a part of the official challenge that Dr. Wood has launched.
Yes? Still there, Jerry? Hello?
Hello?
Still there? Looks like somebody
can you hear me?
Some energy weapons on our radio show here.
Yeah, I guess we got jammed.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's interesting, Kevin.
Oh, boy. I don't even want to go there. But,
To repeat, you know, there's nothing to be gained by, you know, arguing with one another. You know, I respect, those who hold to a different, you know, causal theory, but with respect to the directed energy weapons causal theory, that one has been converted into an actual legal challenge. ARA, SAIC, and these other companies are going to have to come to court. And they're coming to court based upon documents that have been filed that say that directed energy weapons are a causal factor in the destruction of the World Trade Center and that they know it. And that they hid that information from NIST. That's what we say in no uncertain terms.
Well, that'll be interesting to see how it turns out. I still think that arguing against the official story is a lot more of a surefire winner than trying to come up with an alternative explanation and trying to back that up. But I sure wish you luck, and we'll be back to talk some more about it in just a moment. This is Kevin Barrett here on Truth Jihad Radio. Stick around. Yeah, some people don't want to face it. Look at ex-president Clinton. When he is confronted by a 9/11 truth person, he says, "How dare you? How dare you suggest it was an inside job?" Well, You know, some people in the 9/11 truth believe in the movement turn to folks who point at some anomalous evidence and suggest anomalous possible causes, and they say, how dare you? How dare you go there? Well, I don't think it's necessarily such a horribly daring thing, really, to just look at this stuff and point out when there are some really, you know, interesting, massive anomalies that go far beyond disproving the official story and even, you know, show us that whatever happened to those Twin Towers was something pretty much of a first in demolition history, as Sophia puts it so eloquently in 9/11 Mysteries. And I'm happy to have with us tonight Judy Wood, who's gone where no researcher, she goes boldly where no researcher has gone before. And, of course, Jerry Liepart, who is helping out on the legal end of things, going after the NIST cover-up artist and others. We do have another caller. It's James from Virginia. So how you doing, James?
Hello. Hey, y'all.
How you doing?
It's James from Total411.info.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to say a couple things. First, on the squib issue, Kevin, did you see the History Channel attack piece a few weeks ago?
You know, I hate to admit it because I'm supposed to have seen everything and know everything, but no, I actually never saw it. I don't have a TV, and so I have
One of the so-called debunker people, I forget which one, made the point that those aren't squibs. That's just the building turning to dust above it being pushed out the ventilation system, which actually makes sense more than squibs, but it begs the question, why is the building turning to dust from the top down, which is what the question Dr. Wood is trying to answer, I think.
What do you think, Judy?
Well, first of all, you mentioned about finding what's wrong with the official story rather than finding what did happen. And I feel that's pretty much what I'm doing, is eliminating what did not happen. And what did not happen is a gravity collapse with kerosene. Also, the kinetic energy weapons do not explain what happened for a number of reasons. But what we do see is a bunch of building turning to dust, as James pointed out. And, for example, these wheat chicks falling through the air, trailing dust, that never hit the ground because they turned to dust before they hit the ground. So it isn't something slamming into something else that caused it to turn to dust. It's just encountering air.
Where can people see the wheat chicks turning to dust?
If you go to my front page, drjudywood.com, and right underneath the billiard ball diagram, there's the dirt series, and it's on the first page of the dirt series, and actually the little picture you click on, it's right underneath where it says start here, you click on the picture just below that to the left, the Alka-Seltzer dirt one.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of terms that I'm using because I don't know what phenomena these are. There's a bunch of different things we see going on, and so I've picked generic terms to identify each one of these different phenomena that I've identified. In this particular one, I call Alka-Seltzer. It looks like the steel looks like Alka-Seltzer dissolving as it goes down. So if you go down on that Dirt 1 page to Figure 8 and Figure 9, you'll see these wheat chicks falling, turning into dust. You also see aluminum pieces falling, the aluminum cladding from the outside of the building, and it is not trailing dust.
That is interesting. Do the videos bear out that what's happening here is that these are turning to dust and that the trails that they appear to be leaving behind them are part of are being caused by them turning to dust?
Well, actually, you know, if I might just briefly say that when people look at photographs and at, you know, video information, they may legitimately differ. I know of people who, when they look at photographs and video that I think show the Twin Towers turning to dust, not to mention all the other indicators of dust, you know, they will say, no, it's not turning to dust. And I respect that. You know, people can look at such information and come to different conclusions. What I would say, in conclusion here, is that viewing the photograph video and coming to the conclusion that you are viewing material instantaneously turning to dust is a reasonable conclusion to draw from what is seen.
And I guess I can see that as a moderately reasonable conclusion from these photographs, and also from the famous video clip of the spires seemingly sort of disappearing into dust. The alternative explanation that those spires were toppling and dust was being dislodged from them looks to me to be a less obvious interpretation than the first one.
Correct, but there's another piece of information as well. After these pieces that are trailing dust, you know, continue, a few seconds later, they don't hit the ground. There's nothing on the ground. You don't have steel wheat checks laying all over the ground. So that's another piece of evidence that goes with these photos.
You know, much less accumulating to, you know, several or up to 20 stories high. That doesn't happen either.
You know how many of these wheat checks there should have been? There were over 7,000 of these wheat checks, like the one you see falling in Figure 8.
And those are the aluminum cladding on the outside of the building?
No, the groups of three columns that are 3 floors tall.
Oh, okay. Those are
three floors tall and 7,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So those clusters.
So these clusters of columns, you're saying there should have been lots more of them left on the ground than there actually were.
Correct.
Well, that's again.
Yeah, you see maybe a dozen or two.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if people have followed us to this particular page on your site, they will notice that there are some of these pictures that we mentioned earlier that suggest that there was really no rubble pile to speak of, that you can see that it's just about ground level. There's the pedestrian bridge, there's the 8-story World Trade Center Building 6 towering over what was left of the towers. Which is nothing.
And those pieces that you see, like in Figure 11, those pieces you see in the bottom left corner, those are aluminum cladding pieces. No steel. We checked there.
So the aluminum seemed to survive and fall more than the steel did.
Right, yes.
Again, an interesting phenomenon, and I wonder why people are so they get so upset about discussing these things. You know, I think when I saw your presentation in Madison, Judy, I thought it was a very good presentation. I thought that you did a good job of showing really interesting photos suggesting, you know, these anomalous things. And I don't see why we can't talk about these things in public. I think we might want to be careful about how we talk about them. You know, choose our language carefully so it can't be used too easily against us. But there is such an interesting array of this anomalous evidence that clearly disproves the official story and is also shows us that we're so far outside of the realm of conventional controlled demolition that it isn't even funny. It's leading us hopefully towards the truth.
You know, and early on in the show, Kevin, you know, you mentioned perhaps, you know, rhetorically that, you know, maybe people want to stay away from the directed energy weapons causal theory because it asks too much of the imagination. So in putting it that way, one is actually saying we should not discuss that particular issue for political reasons, namely that it requires too much of the viewing public, so to speak. Now, you know, I respect that point of view. I disagree with it, but, you know, I can understand how people might come to that point of view. And if that's the point of view that they want to have, they're welcome to have it. I understand. People do not want to discuss directed energy weapons as a causal factor in the destruction of the World Trade Center because it demands too much from listeners or those who are receiving the information. Fine, I get it. I grasp it. I do not agree with it.
I can see another reason why folks would want to stay away from it.
And what would that be?
It's pretty scary. It's pretty horrible to think that this went on. And folks would rather put their head in the sand.
Right. It's a form of the denial mechanism, and denial can have a self-protective function.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would rather not have to consider issues like this. However, the cost for engaging in denial can be much worse than the process itself. And that would be my contention, that while I understand the analgesic function, perhaps, that, you know, denial might bring about, but at the end of the day, doing so prevents us from getting at the truth of what happened, and that is a far worse outcome.
Well, there is so much denial just based on the horror and the suffering, but I'm not sure that that horror and suffering is necessarily any greater, whether the thousands missing bodies, of which nothing was recovered, not even a DNA molecule, if that was caused by those bodies being blown up with explosives, or by being blown to bits with some other form of high-energy destructive device, I'm not sure it really matters that much. I don't see why we would need to be more in denial about one mechanism for demolition as opposed to another.
I don't either.
Yeah, I talked to Ken Jenkins on my GCN show yesterday. Oops, I mentioned that evil rival network. But anyway, we had a real good show, and Ken points out that it has to do with people's personality. You know, some people just are more conservative in the way they want to talk about evidence, and others are less conservative, and so he thinks that it's mostly a personality issue, and that what we really need is to be able to stop letting these personality issues get in our way. And I agree with that. I think that
I find that interesting too, Kevin.
Right, and so it may not really be as much a scientific dispute in some cases as a kind of a personality conflict.
Yeah.
What I've tried to do is just look at the evidence and just see it for what it is. Just look as though you're that person standing there taking the picture. What do you see? What do you feel?
And I think that's so important. And again, as I said, that looking at these pictures that's part of what brought me around on 9/11. Besides hearing that David Griffin was working on his book, I got a hold of Erica Huffschmidt's book, which is a very good collection of photographs. And the photographs speak for themselves. And likewise, if people look at your website, regardless of whether they agree with all of your conclusions or want to side with you in whatever kinds of disputes are out there, I think they have to admit that these are very interesting photographs, and the questions you ask about many of them are very good questions. Okay, we have a caller. It's Michael from Oklahoma. Come on in, Michael.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. How are you?
And hello, Judy, and is it Jerry?
Yes.
The first thing I want to do is to salute all of you for doing what you're doing and have the courage to pursue the lines that you're pursuing.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
Thank you very much.
It's sure. I think that's a good observation that Ken made, by the way, about different personalities taking different paths in this gigantic thing that we're all attempting. I had one observation. It's sort of an argumentative, conceptual observation having to do with the discussion that we've all been in for at least a couple of years now. It seems that when we're trying to explain the observed phenomena of especially the towers, it seems like Building 7 is a lot easier. But the towers, the observed phenomena, it seems like our discussions always fall into exotic or conventional weaponry being used. And in the exotic camp, we almost always exclusively talk about directed energy weapons, whereas when we're talking about conventional weapons, we're talking about explosives or kinetic energy weapons. My point is that would it not also be valid to talk about exotic explosive weapons? It seems like there would be a lot of research having been done in that area since 1945 as well. And And the a lot of the phenomena that we see and the evidence that we see, one thing is not only the testimony of explosions, but it's also that several of the witnesses talk about the highly sequenced explosions, especially in the final roll, that it was just a very fast top-to-bottom sequence of explosions. And from the visual evidence, we can see that much of it was from the inside out. So would it not be the case that some of the phenomena that we're attributing to directed energy weapons could also be exotic explosive weapons?
We're getting into semantics here. What I determine as what I call directed energy weapons, it's energy that's directed and it's used as a weapon.
I see. So it could also be that they are positioned inside the buildings. I mean, the direction could be from inside out, you're saying.
But I believe that it's, yes, but I don't, I think you're still kind of talking about a kinetic energy device. And I think that there's something that's a different kind of process, but it's very directed. It's not random. It's not in all directions. For example, Building 7, it didn't even spill out into a lane of traffic. That's pretty amazing. A 47-story building going away and not even spilling across the street.
It's also amazing how the top part of the South Tower tilted over and then just disappeared instead of falling to the ground.
Leave a hole in the ground.
That's right. We'll be back in a couple of minutes here. This is Kevin Barrett on Truth Jihad Radio right here at republicbroadcasting.org. Talking with Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart. Stick around. Batiste doesn't have a chance until we take down this ridiculous official story of September 11th. Well, this is Kevin Barrett here on Truth Jihad Radio. I'm one of only three people that I know of who've been forced out of tenure track or tenured academic jobs for pursuing the truth about 9/11. The other two people are noted scientists, Judy Wood and Stephen Jones. And I guess I'll let them do the science and I'll do the radio show. But hey, I'm flattered to be considered anywhere near as dangerous as they are. So, Judy, we do have another caller. It's John from Texas. Come on in, John.
Good evening, Judy and Jerry.
Good evening.
I wanted to comment that I think it's important that we don't get caught up in kind of a JFK type syndrome. We didn't know all the details about the shooting of JFK, and I would entertain the idea that we're not going to know all the details of 9/11 for many years to come. I concur with you that there are many different ways to look at what happened, and different people evaluate or their analysis are going to differ. But one thing is quite evident, I believe, and that is that a guy with a laptop and an AK in a cave in Afghanistan didn't mastermind this operation. If you look at the events of 9/11 and consider who pro bono, who benefited, and also if you look at follow the money trail, I think it's quite evident that our government had to be complicit in these events. And I think the important thing is it doesn't matter how the events of 9/11 happened or exactly who did them. What is important is who was responsible. And there are two people that were responsible, and that's our president and our vice president. And these two individuals are still pursuing their global endeavor, and they are still benefiting from the events of cause and effect of 9/11.
Well, that's a good point. And as you said, that a guy in a cave in Afghanistan didn't do it, and neither did 19 pseudo-Muslim patsies borrowed from Saudi intelligence. That makes 9/11 a blood libel aimed at whipping up murderous hatred of Muslims, and over a million people have been killed now because they were perceived as Muslims. This is a genocide and a blood libel. It's right up there with the Final Solution. And anybody who's giving support to the official story of 9/11 is the moral equivalent of people giving support to the Holocaust while it was going on. So we need to really think seriously about this and get pretty hardcore about the way we deal with this. It's a moral issue of our times. Well, thank you, John, for your comments. Thank you, Jerry and Judy, for your wonderful conversation. I hope to have you back sometime.
Well, thanks for having me on. That's speaking for me.
Okay.
Thanks for having us on.
Okay, it was great. And we will be back again, same time, same channel, next week, right here on RepublicBroadcasting.org.